This is Audible.
Books on Tape presents A Storm of Swords, Book 3 of A Song of Ice and Fire, by George R. R. Martin, read by Roy Dotrice. Prologue. The day was grey and bitter cold, and the dogs would not take the scent. The big black bitch had taken one sniff at the bear tracks, backed off, and skulked back to the pack with her tail between her legs. The dogs huddled together miserably on the river bank as the wind snapped at them. Chet felt it too, biting through his layers of black wool and boiled leather. It was too bloody cold for man or beast, but here they were. His mouth twisted, and he could almost feel the boils that covered his cheeks and neck, growing red and angry.
"I should be safe back at the wall, tending the bloody ravens, and making fires for old Maester Aemon."
It was the bastard John Snow who had taken that from him, and his fat friend Sam Tarley. It was their fault he was here, freezing his bloody balls off with a pack of hounds deep in the haunted forest.
"Seven elves!"
He gave the leashes a hard yank to get the dog's attention.
"Track, you bastards! That's a bear print! You want some meat or no? Find!"
But the hounds only huddled closer, whining. Chet snapped his short lash above their heads, and the black bitch snarled at him.
"Dog meat would taste as good as bear," he warned her, his breath frosting with every word.
Lark, the sister man, stood with his arms crossed over his chest, and his hands tucked up into his armpits. He wore black wool gloves, but he was always complaining how his fingers were frozen.
"It's too bloody cold, Daunt," he said. "Bugger this bear, he's not worth freezing over."
"We can't go back empty hand, Lark,"
rumbled Small Paw through the brown whiskers that covered most of his face.
"The Lord Commander wouldn't like that."
There was ice under the big man's squash pug nose where his snot had frozen. A huge hand in a thick fur glove clenched tight around the shaft of a spear.
"Bugger that old bear, too,"
said the sister man, a thin man with sharp features and nervous eyes.
"Mormont will be dead before daybreak, remember? Who cares what he likes?"
Small Paul blinked his black little eyes. Maybe he had forgotten, Chet thought. He was stupid enough to forget almost anything.
"Why do we have to kill the old bear? Why don't we just go off and let him be?"
"You think he'd let us be?" said Lark. "He'll hunt us down. You want to be hunted, you great muttonhead?"
"No," said Small Paul. "I don't want that. I don't."
"So you'll kill him?" said Lark.
"Yes."
The huge man stamped the butt of his spear on the frozen river bank.
"I will. He shouldn't hunt us."
The sister man took his hands from his armpits and turned to Chet.
"We need to kill all the officers, I see."
Chet was sick of hearing it.
"We've been over this. The old bear dies, and Blaine from the Shadow Tower. Grubbs and Aethon as well. They're ill luck for drawing the watch. Darwin and Bannon for their tracking, and Sir Piggy for the ravens. That's all. We kill 'em quiet while they sleep. One scream and we're worm food, every one of us."
His boils were red with rage.
"Just do your bit, and see that your cousins do theirs. And Paul, try and remember it's third watch, not second."
"Third watch," the big man said through hair and frozen snot. "Me and Softfoot. I remember, Chet."
The moon would be black tonight, and they had jiggered the watches so as to have 8 of their own standing sentry, with 2 more guarding the horses. It wasn't going to get much riper than that. Besides, the wildlings could be upon them any day now. Chet meant to be well away from here before that happened. He meant to live. 300 sworn brothers of the Night's Watch had ridden north, 200 from Castle Black, and another 100 from the Shadow Tower. It was the biggest ranging in living memory, near to a third of the Watcher's strength. They meant to find Ben Stark, Sir Waymar Royce, and the other rangers who'd gone missing, and discover why the wildlings were leaving their villages. Well, they were no closer to Stark and Royce than when they'd left the wall, but they'd learn where all the wildlings had gone. Up into the icy heights of the godforsaken Frostfangs. They could squat up there till the end of time, and it wouldn't prick Chet's boils none. But no, they were coming down, down the Milkwater. Chet raised his eyes, and there it was. The river's stony banks were bearded by ice, its pale milky waters flowing endlessly down out of the Frostfangs. And now Mance Rayder and his wildlings were flowing down the same way. Thorin Smallwood had returned in a ladder 3 days past. While he was telling the old bear what his scouts had seen, his man, Kedge Whiteye, told the rest of them.
"They're still well up the foothills, but they're coming," Kedge said, warming his hands over the fire. "Hama, the dog's head, has a van, the poxy bitch. Goldie crept up on her camp and saw her playing by the fire. That fool, Dumblejohn, wanted to pick her off with an arrow, but Smallwood had better sense." Chet spat. "How many were there, could you tell?" "Oh, many and more. 20, 30,000. We didn't stay to count. Armour had 500 in the van, everyone a horse."
The men around the fire exchanged uneasy looks. It was a rare thing to find even a dozen mounted wildlings. And 500?
"Smallwood sent Bannon and me wide round the van to catch a peek at the main body," Kedge went on. "There was no end of them. They're moving slow as a frozen river, 4-5 miles a day, but they don't look like they mean to go back to their villages, neither. More than half were women and children, and they were driving their animals before them, goats, sheep, even oryxes dragging sledges. They'd loaded up with bales of fur and sides of meat, cages of chickens, butter churns and spinning wheels, every damn thing they own. The mules and garrons were so heavy laden, you think their backs would break. The women as well."
"And they follow the Milkwater?" Lark, the sister man, asked.
"I said so, didn't I?"
The Milkwater would take them past the Fist of the First Men, the ancient ring fort where the Night's Watch had made his camp. Any man with a thimble of sense could see that it was time to pull up stakes and fall back on the wall. The old bear had strengthened the fist with spikes and pits and caltrops, but against such a host all that was pointless. If they stayed here, they would be engulfed and overwhelmed. And Thorin Smallwood wanted to attack. Sweet Donal Hill was squire to Sir Malador Locke, and the night before last Smallwood had come to Locke's tent. Sir Malador had been of the same mind as old Sir Otten Withers, urging a retreat on the wall. But Smallwood wanted to convince him otherwise.
"This king beyond the wall will never look for us so far north," Sweet Donal reported him saying, "and this great host of his is a shambling horde, full of useless mouths who won't know what end of a sword to hold. One blow will take all the fight out of them and send them howling back to their hovels for another 50 years.
300 against 30,000. Chet called that rank madness. And what was madder still was that Sir Malador had been persuaded, and the two of them together were on the point of persuading the old bear.
"If we wait too long, this chance may be lost, never to come again,"
Smallwood was saying to anyone who would listen. Against that, Sir Otten Withers said,
"We are the shield that guards the realms of men. You do not throw away your shield for no good purpose."
But to that Thorin Smallwood said,
"In a sword for fair fight, a man's surest defence is a swift stroke that slays his foe, not cringing behind a shield."
Neither Smallwood nor Withers had the command, though. Lord Mormont did, and Mormont was waiting for his other scouts, for Jarman Buckwell and the men who'd climbed the giant stair, and for Corrin Halfhand and Jon Snow, who'd gone to probe the Skirling Pass. Buckwell and the Halfhand were late in returning, though.
"Dead, most like.
Chet pictured Jon Snow lying blue and frozen on some bleak mountaintop with a wildling spear up his bastard arse. The thought made him smile.
I hope they killed his bloody wolf as well.
There's no bear here, he decided abruptly. Just an old print, that's all. Back to the fist. The dogs almost yanked him off his feet, as eager to get back as he was. Maybe they thought they were going to get fed. Chet had to laugh. He hadn't fed them for 3 days now, to turn them mean and hungry. Tonight, before slipping off into the dark, he'd turn them loose among the horse lines, after sweet Donald Hill and Clubfoot Carl cut the tethers.
They'll have snarling hounds and panicked horses all over the fist, running through fires, jumping the ring wall, and trampling down tents.
With all the confusion, it might be hours before anyone noticed that 14 brothers were missing. Lark had wanted to bring in twice that number, but what could you expect from some stupid fish-breath sister man? Whisper a word in the wrong ear, and before you knew it, you'd be short ahead. No, 14 was a good number, enough to do what needed doing, but not so many that they couldn't keep the secret. Chet had recruited most of them himself. Small Paul was one of his, the strongest man on the wall, even if he was slower than a dead snail. He'd once broken a wildling's back with a hug. They had Dirk as well, named for his favourite weapon, and the little grey man the brothers called Softfoot, who'd raped 100 women in his youth, and liked to boast how none had never seen nor heard him until he shoved it up inside them. The plan was Chet's. He was the clever one. He'd been steward to old Maester Aemon for 4 good years before that bastard Jon Snow had done him out, so his job could be handed to that fat pig of a friend. When he killed Sam Tarly tonight, he planned to whisper,
"Give my love to Lord Snow,"
right in his ear before he sliced the piggy's throat open to let the blood come bubbling out through all those layers of suet. Chet knew the ravens, so he wouldn't have no trouble there. No more than he would with Tarly. One touch of the knife, and that craven would piss his pants and start blubbering for his life.
Let him beg. It won't do him no good.
After he'd opened his throat, he'd open the cages and shoo the birds away, so no messages reached the wall. Softfoot and Small Paul would kill the old bear, Dirk would do Blaine, and Lark and his cousins would silence Bannon and old Dywin to keep them from sniffing after their trail. They'd been caching food for a fortnight, and sweet Donald and Clubfoot Carl would have the horses ready. With Mormont dead, command would pass to Sir Utton Withers, an old Don man, and failing.
He'd be running for the wall before sundown, and he won't waste no men sending them after us neither.
The dogs pulled at him as they made their way through the trees. Chet could see the fist punching its way up through the green. The day was so dark that the old bear had the torches lit, a great circle of them burning all along the ring wall that crowned the top of the steep stony hill. The three of them waded across a brook. The water was icy cold, and patches of ice were spreading across its surface.
"I'm going to make for the coast," Lark the sister man confided. "Me and my cousins will build us a boat, sail back home to the sisters."
"And at home they'll know you for deserters, and lop off your fool heads," thought Chet.
There was no leaving the night's watch, once you said your words. Anywhere in the Seven Kingdoms, they'd take you and kill you. Ollo Lophan now. He was talking about sailing back to Tyrosh, where he claimed men didn't lose their heads for a bit of honest thievery, nor get sent off to freeze their life away for being found in bed with some knight's wife. Chet had Wade going with him, but he didn't speak their wet, girly tongue, and what could he do in Tyrosh? He had no trade to speak of, growing up in Hagsmire. His father had spent his life grubbing in other men's fields and collecting leeches. He'd strip down bare but for a thick leather clout and go wading in the murky waters. When he climbed out, he'd be covered from nipple to ankle. Sometimes he made Chet help pull the leeches off. One had attached itself to his palm once, and he'd smashed it against a wall in revulsion. His father beat him bloody for that. The maesters bought the leeches at 12 for a penny. Lark could go home if he liked, and that damned Tyrushy too, but not yet. If he never saw Hagsmire again, it would be too bloody soon. He had liked the look of Craster's keep himself. Craster lived high as a lord there, so why shouldn't he do the same? That would be a laugh. Chet, the leechman's son, a lord with a keep. His banner could be a dozen leeches on a field of pink. But why stop at lord? Maybe he should be a king.
Mance Rayder started out as a crow. I could be a king, same as him, and have me some wives.
Craster had 19, not even counting the young ones, the daughters he hadn't gotten around to bedding yet. Half them wives were as old and ugly as Craster, but that didn't matter. The old ones Chet could put to work, cooking and cleaning for him, pulling carrots and slopping pigs, while the young ones warmed his bed and bore his children. Craster wouldn't object. Not one small paw gave him a hug. The only women Chet had ever known were the whores he'd bought in Molestown. When he'd been younger, the village girls took one look at his face with its boils and its wen, and turned away sickened. The worst was that slattern Besser. She'd spread her legs for every boy in Hagsmire, so he figured, why not him too? He even spent a morning picking wildflowers when he heard she liked them, but she'd just laughed in his face and told him she'd crawl in a bed with his father's leeches before she'd crawl in one with him. She stopped laughing when he put his knife in her. That was sweet, the look on her face. So he pulled the knife out and put it in her again. When they caught him, down near Seven Streams, old Lord Walder Frey hadn't even bothered to come himself to do the judging. He'd sent one of his bastards, that Walder Rivers, and the next thing Chet had known, he was walking to the war with that foul-smelling black devil Yoren, to pay for his one sweet moment they took his whole life. But now he meant to take it back, and Craster's women too.
That twisted old wildling has the right of it. If you want a woman to wife, you take her, and none of this giving her flowers, so that maybe she don't notice your bloody boils.
Chet didn't mean to make that mistake again. It would work, he promised himself for the 100th time.
So long as we get away clean.
Sir Utin would strike south for the Shadow Tower, the shortest way to the wall.
He won't bother with us, not with us. All he'll want is to get back whole.
Thorin Smallwood now. He'd want to press on with the attack. But Sir Utin's caution ran too deep, and he was senior.
It won't matter anyhow. Once we're gone, Smallwood can attack anyone he likes. What do we care? If none of them ever returns to the wall, no one will ever come looking for us. They'll think we died with the rest.
That was a new thought, and for a moment it tempted him. But they would need to kill Sir Utin and Sir Malador Locke as well, to give Smallwood the command, and both of them were well attended day and night. No, the risk was too great. "Chat," said Smallpaw, as they trudged along a stony game trail through sentinels and soldier pines. "What about the bird?"
"What bloody bird?"
The last thing he needed now was some muttonhead going on about a bird.
"The old bear's raven," Smallpaw said. "If we kill him, who's going to feed his bird?"
"Who bloody well cares? Kill a bird too, if you like."
"I don't want to kill no bird," the big man said. "But that's a talking bird. What if it tells what we did?"
Lark the sister man laughed.
"Smallpaw, thick as a castle wall," he mocked. "You shut up with that," said Smallpaw dangerously.
"Paul," said Chet, before the big man got too angry, "when they find the old man lying in a pool of blood with his throat slit, they won't need no bird to tell them someone killed him."
Smallpaw chewed on that a moment.
"That's true," he allowed. "Can I keep the bird, then? I like that bird."
"He's yours,"
said Chet, just to shut him up.
"We can always eat him, if we get hungry," offered Lark.
Small Paul clouded up again.
"Best not try and eat my bird, Lark. Best not."
Chet could hear voices drifting through the trees.
"Close your bloody mouths, both of you. We're almost to the fist."
They emerged near the west face of the hill and walked around south, where the slope was gentler. Near the edge of the forest, a dozen men were taking archery practice. They had carved outlines on the trunks of trees and were loosing shafts at them.
"Look," said Lark, "a pig with a bow."
Sure enough, the nearest bowman was Sir Piggy himself, the fat boy who had stolen his place with Maester Aemon. Just the sight of Samwell Tarly filled him with anger. Stewarding for Maester Aemon had been as good a life as he'd ever known. The old blind man was undemanding, and Clydus had taken care of most of his wants anyway. Chet's duties were easy. Cleaning the rookery, a few fires to build, a few meals to fetch. And Aemon never once hit him.
"Thinks he can just walk in and shove me out, on account of being high-born and knowing how to read. Might be I'll ask him to read my knife before I open his soap with it."
"You go on," he told the others. "I want to watch this." The dogs were pulling, anxious to go with them, to the food they thought would be waiting at the top. Chet kicked the bitch with the toe of his boot, and that settled them down some. He watched from the trees as the fat boy wrestled with a longbow as tall as he was, his red moon face screwed up with concentration. Three arrows stood in the ground before him. Tarly knocked and drew, held the draw a long moment as he tried to aim and let fly. The shaft vanished into the greenery. Chet laughed loudly, a snort of sweet disgust.
"Cor, we'll never find that one, and I'll be blamed," announced Ed Tollett, the dour, grey-headed squire everyone called Dolorous Ed. "Cor, nothing ever goes missing that they don't look at me. Ever since that time I lost my horse, eh? As if that could be helped. He was white, and it was snowing, eh? What did they expect?"
"The wind took that one," said Gren, another friend of Lord Snow's.
"Try to hold the bow steady, Sam." "That's heavy," the fat boy complained, but he pulled the second arrow all the same.
This one went high, sailing through the branches 10 feet above the target.
I believe you knocked a leaf off that tree," said Dolorous Ed. "Fall is falling fast enough, eh? There's no need to help it."
He sighed.
"And we all know what follows fall, eh? God, but I'm cold. Cor, shoot the last arrow, Samwell. I believe my tongue is freezing to the roof of my mouth, eh?"
So Piggy lowered the bow, and Chet thought he was going to start bawling.
"That's too hard." "Notch, draw, and loose," said Gren. "Go on."
Beautifully, the fat boy plucked his final arrow from the earth, notched it to his longbow, drew, and released. He did it quickly, without squinting along the shaft, painstakingly, as he had the first two times. The arrow struck the charcoal outline low in the chest and hung quivering.
"I hit him!" Sir Piggy sounded shocked. "Gran, did you see? Ed, look, I hit him!"
"Put it between his ribs, I'd say," said Gren.
"Did I kill him?" the fat boy wanted to know.
Tullet shrugged. "Might have punctured a lung if he had a lung. Most trees don't, as a rule, eh?" He took the bow from Sam's hand.
"I've seen worse shots, though. Oi, and made a few."
Sir Piggy was beaming. To look at him, you'd think he'd actually done something. But when he saw Chet and the dogs, his smile curled up and died squeaking.
"You hit a tree," Chet said. "Let's see how you shoot when it's Manse Raider's lads. They won't stand there with their arms out and their leaves rustling. Oh, no, they'll come right at you, screaming in your face, and I bet you'll piss those britches. One of them will plant his axe right between those little pig eyes. The last thing you'll hear will be the thunk it makes
when it bites into your skull."
The fat boy was shaking. Dolorous Ed put a hand on his shoulder. "Brother," he said solemnly, "just because it happened that way for you doesn't mean Samwell will suffer the same, eh?"
"What are you talking about, Tullet?"
"Call that axe that split your skull, eh? Is it true that half your wits leaked out on the ground and your dogs ate them, eh?" The big lout grin laughed, and even Samwell Tarly managed a weak little smile. Chet kicked the nearest dog, yanked on their leashes, and started up the hill.
"Smile all you want, Sir Piggy. We'll see who laughs tonight."
He only wished he had time to kill Tullet as well.
"Gloomy, horse-faced fool, that's what he is."
The climb was steep, even on this side of the fist, which had the gentler slope. Partway up, the dog started barking and pulling at him, figuring that they'd get fed soon. He gave them a taste of his boot instead, and a crack of the whip for the big ugly one that snapped at him. Once they were tied up, he went to report.
"The prints were there, like Giant said, but the dogs wouldn't track," he told Mormont in front of his big black tent. "Down by the river like that. Could be old prints."
"Yeah, Pidgey."
Lord Commander Mormont had a bald head and a great shaggy grey beard, and sounded as tired as he looked.
"We might all have been better for a bit of fresh meat."
The raven on his shoulder bobbed its head and echoed,
"Meat! Meat! Meat!"
"We could cook the bloody dogs," Chet thought, but he kept his mouth shut until the old bear sent him on his way. "And that's the last time I'll need to bow my head to that one," he thought to himself with satisfaction.
It seemed to him that it was growing even colder, which he would have sworn wasn't possible. The dogs huddled together miserably in the hard, frozen mud, and Chet was half tempted to crawl in with them. Instead, he wrapped a black wool scarf around the lower part of his face, leaving a slit for his mouth between the whines. It was warmer if he kept moving, he found, so he made a slow circuit of the perimeter with a wad of sour leaf, sharing a chew or two with the black brothers on guard and hearing what they had to say. None of the men on the day watch were part of his scheme. Even so, he figured it was good to have some sense of what they were thinking. Mostly what they were thinking was that it was bloody cold. The wind was rising as the shadows lengthened. It made a high, thin sound as it shivered through the stones of the ring wall.
"I hate that sound," Little Giant said. "It sounds like a babe in the brush, wailing away for milk."
When he finished the circuit and returned to the dogs, he found Lark waiting for him.
"The officers are in the old bear's tent again, talking something fierce."
"That's what they do," said Chet. "They're high-born, all but Blaine. They get drunk on words instead of wine."
Lark sidled closer.
"Cheese for wits. Keeps going on about the bird," he warned, glancing about to make certain no one was close. "Now he's asking if we cached any seed for the damn thing."
"It's a raven," said Chet. "It eats corpses."
Lark grinned.
"Is, might be."
"Or yours."
It seemed to Chet that they needed the big man more than they needed Lark.
"Stop fretting about small Paul. You do your part, he'll do his."
Twilight was creeping through the woods by the time he rid himself of the sister man and sat down to edge his sword. It was bloody hard work, with his gloves on, but he wasn't about to take them off. Cold as it was, any fool that touched steel with a bare hand was going to lose a patch of skin. The dogs whimpered when the sun went down. He gave them water and curses.
"Half a night more, and you can find your own feast."
By then he could smell supper. Dywin was holding forth at the cook fire as Chet got his heel of hard bread and a bowl of bean and bacon soup from Hake the cook.
"The wood's too silent," the old forester was saying. "No frogs near that river. No owls in the dark. I never heard no dead of wood in this."
"Them teeth of yours sound pretty dead," said Hake.
Dywin clacked his wooden teeth.
"No woods neither. There was before, but no more. Where'd they go, you figure?"
"Someplace warm," said Chet.
Of the dozen-odd brothers who sat by the fire, four were his. He gave each one a hard, squinty look as he ate, to see if any showed signs of breaking. Dirk seemed calm enough, sitting silent and sharpening his blade the way he did every night, and sweet Donald Hill was all easy japes. He had white teeth and fat red lips and yellow locks that he wore in an artful tumble about his shoulders, and he came to be the bastard of some Lannister. Well, maybe he was at that. Chet had no use for pretty boys, nor for bastards neither, but sweet Donald seemed like to hold his own. He was less certain about the forester the brothers called Saw Wood, more for his snoring than for anything to do with trees. Just now he looked so restless he might never snore again. And Maslin was worse. Chet could see sweat trickling down his face, despite the frigid wind. The beads of moisture sparkled in the firelight like so many little wet jewels. Maslin wasn't eating neither, only staring at his soup, as if the smell of it was about to make him sick.
"I'll need to watch that one," Chet thought.
"Assemble!" The shout came suddenly from a dozen throats, and quickly spread to every part of the hilltop camp.
"Men of the Night's Watch, assemble at the central fire!"
Frowning, Chet finished his soup and followed the rest. The old bear stood before the fire, with Smallwood, Locke, Withers, and Blaine ranged behind him in a row. Mormont wore a cloak of thick black fur, and his raven perched upon his shoulder, preening its black feathers.
"This can't be good."
Chet squeezed between Brown Banar and some Shadow Tower men. When everyone was gathered, save for the watchers in the woods and the guards on the ring wall, Mormont cleared his throat and spat. The spittle was frozen before it hit the ground.
"Brothers," he said, "men of the Night's Watch."
"Men,"
his raven screamed.
"Men! Men!"
"The wildlings are on the march, following the course of the Milkwater down out of the mountains. Thorin believes their van will be upon us 10 days hence. Their most seasoned raiders will be with Harmer Dogshead in that van. The rest will likely form a rear guard, or ride in close company with Mance Raider himself. Elsewhere their fighters will be spread thin along the line of march. They have oxen, mules, horses, but few enough. Most will be afoot, and ill-armed and untrained. Such weapons as they carry are more like to be stone and bone than steel. They are burdened with women, children, herds of sheep and goats, and all their worldly goods besides. In short, though they are numerous, they are vulnerable, and they do not know that we are here. Or so we must pray." "They know," thought Chet. "You bloody old pusbag, they know. Certain as sunrise. Corin Halfhand hasn't come back, has he? Nor Jarmin Buckwell. If any of them got caught, you know damn well the wildlings will have wrung a song or two out of them by now."
Smallwood stepped forward.
"Mance Raider means to break the wall and bring Red War to the Seven Kingdoms. Well, that's a game two can play. On the morrow, we'll bring the war to him."
"We ride at dawn with all our strength," the old bear said, as a murmur went through the assembly. "We will ride north and loop around to the west. Harmer's van will be well past the fist by the time we turn. The foothills of the Frostfangs are full of narrow, winding valleys made for ambush. Their line of march will stretch for many miles. We shall fall on them in several places at once, and make them swear we were 3,000, not 300.
"We'll hit hard and be away before the horsemen can form up to face us," Thorin Smallwood said. "If they pursue, we'll lead them a merry chase, then wheel and hit again further down the column. We'll burn their wagons, scatter their herds, and slay as many as we can. Mance Raider himself, if we find him,
If they break and return to their hovels, we've won. If not, we'll harrow them all the way to the wall and see to it that they leave a trail of corpses to mark their progress.
There are thousands, someone called from behind Chet.
We'll die!
That was Maslin's voice, green with fear.
Die!
Screamed Mormon's raven, flapping its black wings.
Die! Die! Die!
Many of us, the old bear said, mayhaps even all of us, but as another Lord Commander said, 1,000 years ago, that is why they dress us in black. Remember your words, brothers, for we are the swords in the darkness, the watchers on the walls.
The fire that burns against the cold,
Sir Maldor Luck drew his longsword.
The light that brings the dawn,
others answered, and more swords were pulled from scabbards. Then all of them were drawing, and it was near 300 upraised swords, and as many voices crying, "The horn that wakes the sleepers, the shield that guards the realms of men!"
Chet had no choice but to join his voice to the others. The air was misty with their breath, and firelight glinted off the steel. He was pleased to see Lark and Softfoot and sweet Donald Hill joining in, as if they were as big fools as the rest. That was good. No sense to draw attention when their ire was so close. When the shouting died away, once more he heard the sound of the wind picking at the ring wall. The flames swirled and shivered, as if they too were cold, and in the sudden quiet the old bear's raven cawed loudly and once again said,
"Die!"
Clever bird, thought Chet, as the officers dismissed them, warning everyone to get a good meal and a long rest tonight. Chet crawled under his furs near the dogs, his head full of things that could go wrong. What if that bloody oath gave one of his a change of heart? Or Small Paul forgot and tried to kill Mormont during the second watch in place of the third? Or Maslin lost his courage, or someone turned informer, or... He found himself listening to the night. The wind did sound like a wailing child, and from time to time he could hear men's voices, a horse's whinny, a log spitting in the fire, but nothing else.
So quiet.
He could see Bessa's face floating before him.
"It wasn't a knife I wanted to put in you,"
he wanted to tell her.
"I picked you flowers, wild roses, and tansy, and golden cups. It took me all morning."
His heart was thumping like a drum, so loud he feared it might wake the camp. Ice caked his beard all round his mouth.
"Where did that come from, with Bessa?"
Whenever he'd thought of her before, it had only been to remember the way she looked, dying. What was wrong with him? He could hardly breathe. Had he gone to sleep? He got to his knees, and something wet and cold touched his nose. Chet looked up. Snow was falling. He could feel tears freezing to his cheeks.
"It isn't fair," he wanted to scream.
Snow would ruin everything he'd worked for, all his careful plans. It was a heavy fall, thick white flakes coming down all about him. How would they find their food caches in the snow, or the game trail they meant to follow east?
"They won't need Darwin nor Bannon to hunt us down, neither. Not if we're tracking through fresh snow."
And snow hid the shape of the ground, especially by night. A horse could stumble over a root, break a leg on a stone.
"We're done," he realized. "Done before we began. We're lost."
There'd be no lord's life for the leechman's son. No keep to call his own, no wives, no crowns. Only a wildling sword in his belly, and then an unmarked grave.
"The snow's taken it all from me. A bloody snow."
Snow had ruined him once before. Snow and his pet pig. Chet got to his feet. His legs were stiff, and the falling snowflakes turned the distant torches to vague orange glows.
He felt as though he were being attacked by a cloud of pale, cold bugs. They settled on his shoulders, on his head. They flew at his nose and his eyes. Cursing, he brushed them off.
"Samuel Tarly," he remembered. "I can still deal with Sir Picky."
He wrapped his scarf around his face, pulled up his hood, and went striding through the camp to where the cowards slept. The snow was falling so heavily that he got lost among the tents, but finally he spotted a snug little windbreak the fat boy had made for himself between a rock and the raven cages. Tarly was buried beneath a mound of black wool blankets and shaggy furs. The snow was drifting in to cover him. He looked like some kind of soft round mountain. Steel whispered on leather, faint as hope, as Chet eased his dagger from his sheath. One of the ravens quarked.
"Snow,"
murmured another, peering through the bars with black eyes. The first added a "snow" of its own.
He edged past them, placing each foot carefully. He would clap his left hand down over the fat boy's mouth to muffle his cries, and then,
"Ooh!"
He stopped mid-step, swallowing his curse, as the sound of the horn shuddered through the camp, faint and far yet unmistakable.
"Not now! Gods be damned, not now!"
The old bear had hidden far eyes in the ring of trees around the fist to give warning of any approach.
"Jarman Buckwell's back from the giant stair," Chet figured, "or Corin Halfhand from the Skirling Pass."
A single blast of the horn meant brothers returning. If it was the Halfhand, Jon Snow might be with him, alive. Sam Tarly sat up, puffy-eyed, and stared at the snow in confusion. The ravens were cawing noisily, and Chet could hear his dogs baying.
"Half the bloody camp's awake."
His gloved fingers clenched round the dagger's hilt as he waited for the sound to die away. But no sooner had it gone than it came again, louder and longer.
"Ooh! Gods!"
he heard Sam Tarly whimper. The fat boy lurched to his knees, his feet tangled in his cloak and blankets. He kicked them away and reached for a chainmail hauberk he'd hung on the rock nearby. As he slipped the huge tent of a garment down over his head and wriggled into it, he spied Chet standing there.
"Was it two?" he asked. "I dreamed I heard two blasts."
"No dream," said Chet. "Two blasts to call the watch to arms. Two blasts for foes approaching. There's an axe out there with Piggy writ on it, fat boy. Two blasts means wildlings."
The fear on that big moon face made him want to laugh.
"Bugger them all to Seven Hells. Bloody armor, bloody Manse Raider, bloody Smallwood," he said. "They wouldn't be on us for another—"
"Ooh!"
The sound went on and on and on until it seemed it would never die. The ravens were flapping and screaming, flying about their cages and banging off the bars, and all about the camp the brothers of the Night's Watch were rising, donning their armor, buckling on sword belts, reaching for battle axes and bows. Samuel Tarly stood shaking, his face the same color as the snow that swirled down all around them.
"Three," he squeaked to Chet. "That was three. I heard three. Oh, they never blow three. Not for hundreds and thousands of years. Three means—"
"Others."
Chet made a sound that was half a laugh and half a sob. And suddenly, his small clothes were wet, and he could feel the piss running down his leg, see steam rising off the front of his breeches. Bran. The ridge slanted sharply from the earth, a long fold of stone and soil, shaped like a claw. Trees clung to its lower slopes, pines and hawthorn and ash. But higher up the ground was bare, the ridgeline stark against the cloudy sky. He could feel the high stone calling him, Up he went, loping easily at first, then faster and higher, his strong legs eating up the incline. Birds burst from the branches overhead as he raced by, clawing and flapping their way into the sky. He could hear the wind sighing up amongst the leaves, the squirrels chittering to one another, even the sound a pine cone made as it tumbled to the forest floor. The smells were a song around him, a song that filled the good green world. Gravel flew from beneath his paws as he gained the last few feet to stand upon the crest. The sun hung above the tall pines, huge and red, and below him the trees and hills went on and on as far as he could see or smell. A kite was circling far above, dark against the pink sky. "Prince," the man's sound came into his head suddenly, yet he could feel the rightness of it. "Prince of the Green, Prince of the Wolf's Wood." He was strong and swift and fierce, and all that lived in the good green world went in fear of him. Far below, at the base of the woods, something moved against the trees, a flash of grey, quick glimpsed and gone again. But it was enough to make his ears prick up. Down there, beside a swift green brook, another form slipped by, running. Wolves, he knew. His little cousins, chasing down some prey. Now the prince could see more of them, shadows on fleet grey paws. A pack. He had a pack as well once. 5 they had been, and a 6th who stood aside. Somewhere down inside him were the sounds the men had given them to tell one from the other, but it was not by their sounds he knew them. He remembered their scents, his brothers and his sisters. They all had smelled alike, had smelled of pack, but each was different, too. His angry brother, with the hot green eyes, was near, the prince felt, though he had not seen him for many hunts. Yet with every sun that set he grew more distant, and he had been the last. The others were far scattered, like leaves blown by the wild wind. Sometimes he could sense them, though, as if they were still with him, only hidden from his sight by a boulder or a stand of trees. He could not smell them, nor hear their howls by night, yet he felt their presence at his back, all but the sister they had lost. His tail drooped when he remembered her. 4 now, not 5, 4, and one more, the white who has no voice. These woods belonged to them, the snowy slopes and stony hills, the great green pines and the golden leaf oaks, the rushing streams and blue lakes fringed with fingers of white frost. But his sister had left the wilds to walk in the halls of Manrock, where other hunters ruled, and once within those halls it was hard to find the path back out. The wolf prince remembered. The wind shifted suddenly. Deer and fear and blood. The scent of prey woke the hunger in him. The prince sniffed the air again, turning, and then he was off, bounding along the ridgetop with jaws half parted. The far side of the ridge was steeper than the one he'd come up, but he flew sure-foot over stones and roots and rotting leaves, down the slope and through the trees, long strides eating up the ground. The scent pulled him onward, ever faster. The deer was down and dying when he reached her, ringed by 8 of his small grey cousins. The heads of the pack had begun to feed, the male first, and then his female, taking turns tearing flesh from the red underbelly of their prey. The others waited patiently, all but the tail, who paced in a wary circle a few strides from the rest, his own tail tucked low. He would eat last of all, whatever his brothers left him. The prince was downwind, so they did not sense him until he leapt upon a fallen log 6 strides from where they fed. The tail saw him first, gave a piteous whine, and slunk away. His pack brothers turned at the sound and bared their teeth, snarling, all but the head male and female. The direwolf answered the snarls with a low warning growl and showed them his own teeth. He was bigger than his cousins, twice the size of the scrawny tail, half again as large as the two pack heads. He leapt down into their midst, and three of them broke, melting away into the brush. Another came at him, teeth snapping. He met the attack head-on, caught the wolf's leg in his jaws when they met, and flung him aside, yelping and limping. And then there was only the head wolf to face. The great grey male, with his bloody muzzle, fresh from his prey's soft belly. There was white on his muzzle as well, to mark him as an old wolf, but when his mouth opened, red slaver ran from his teeth. "He has no fear," the prince thought, "no more than me." It would be a good fight. They went for each other. Long they fought, rolling together over roots and stones and fallen leaves and the scattered entrails of the prey, tearing at each other with tooth and claw, breaking apart, circling each round the other, and bolting in to fight again. The prince was larger and much the stronger, but his cousin had a pack. The female prowled around them closely, snuffing and snarling, and would interpose herself whenever her mate broke off, blooded. From time to time the other wolves would dart in as well, to snap at a leg or an ear when the prince was turned the other way. One angered him so much that he whirled in a black fury and tore out the attacker's throat. After that, the others kept their distance. And as the last red light was filtering through green boughs and golden, the old wolf lay down weary in the dirt and rolled over to expose his throat and belly. It was submission. The prince sniffed at him and licked the blood from fur and torn flesh. When the old wolf gave a soft whimper, the dire wolf turned away. He was very hungry now, and the prey was his. "Hodor!" The sudden sound made him stop and snarl. The wolves regarded him with green and yellow eyes, bright with the last light of day. None of them had heard it. It was a queer wind that blew only in his ears. He buried his jaws into the deer's belly and tore off a mouthful of flesh. "Hodor! Hodor!" "No," he thought, "no, I won't." It was a boy's thought, not a dire wolf's. The woods were darkening all about him, until only the shadows of the trees remained and the glow of his cousin's eyes. And through those, and behind those eyes, he saw a big man's grinning face and a stone vault whose walls were spotted with nitre. The rich warm taste of blood faded on his tongue. "No, don't, I want to eat. I want... "Hodor, Hodor, 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 Hodor," Hodor chanted as he shook him softly by the shoulders, back and forth and back and forth. He was trying to be gentle, he always tried, but Hodor was 7 feet tall and stronger than he knew, and his huge hands rattled Bran's teeth together. "No," he shouted angrily, "Hodor, leave off, I'm here, I'm here." Hodor stopped, looking abashed. "Hodor!" The woods and wolves were gone. Bran was back again, down in the damp vault of some ancient watchtower that must have been abandoned thousands of years before. It wasn't much of a tower now. Even the tumbled stones were so overgrown with moss and ivy that you could hardly see them until you were right on top of them. "Tumble-down tower," Bran had named the place. It was Mira who found the way down into the vault, however.
"You were gone too long."
Jojen Reed was 13, only 4 years older than Bran. Jojen wasn't much bigger either, no more than 2 inches or maybe 3, but he had a solemn way of talking that made him seem older and wiser than he really was. At Winterfell, old Nan had dubbed him Little Grandfather. Bran frowned at him.
"I wanted to eat." "Mira will be back soon with supper."
"I'm sick of frogs." Mira was a frog-eater from the neck, so Bran couldn't really blame her for catching so many frogs, he supposed, but even so. I want her to eat the deer. For a moment he remembered the taste of it, the blood, and the raw, rich meat, and his mouth watered. I won the fight for it. I won.
Did you mark the trees?
Bran flushed. Jojen was always telling him to do things when he opened his third eye and put on summer's skin. To claw the bark of a tree, to catch a rabbit and bring it back in his jaws uneaten, to push some rocks in a line. Stupid things.
I forgot, he said. You always forget.
It was true. He meant to do the things that Jojen asked, but once he was a wolf, they never seemed important. There were always things to see and things to smell, a whole green world to hunt. And he could run. There was nothing better than running, unless it was running after prey.
I was a prince, Jojen, he told the older boy. I was the prince of the woods.
You are a prince, Jojen reminded him softly.
You remember, don't you? Tell me who you are. You know.
Jojen was his friend and his teacher, but sometimes Bran just wanted to hit him.
I want you to say the words. Tell me who you are.
Bran, he said sullenly. Bran the Broken. Brandon Stark, a crippled boy. The Prince of Winterfell. Of Winterfell burned and tumbled, its people scattered and slain. The glass gardens were smashed, and hot water gushed from the cracked walls to steam beneath the sun. How can you be the prince of some place you might never see again?
And who is Summer? Jojen prompted.
My direwolf, he smiled. Prince of the Green.
Bran the Boy and Summer the Wolf. You are two, then.
Two, he sighed, and one. He hated Jojen when he got stupid like this. At Winterfell, he wanted me to dream my wolf dreams, and now that I know how, he's always calling me back.
Remember that, Bran. Remember yourself, or the wolf will consume you. When you join, it's not enough to run and hunt and howl in summer's skin.
It is for me, Bran thought. He likes summer's skin better than his own. What good is it to be a skin changer if you can't wear the skin you like?
Will you remember? And next time, mark the tree. Any tree, it doesn't matter, so long as you do it.
I will. I'll remember. I could go back and do it now if you like. I won't forget this time. But I'll eat my deer first, and fight with those little wolves some more. Jojen shook his head.
No, best stay and eat. With your own mouth. A warg cannot live on what his beast consumes.
How would you know? Bran thought resentfully. You've never been a warg. You don't know what it's like. Hodor jerked suddenly to his feet, almost hitting his head on the barrel-vaulted ceiling.
Hodor!
He shouted, rushing to the door. Mira pushed it open just before he reached it, and stepped through into their refuge.
Hodor! Hodor!
The huge stable boy said, grinning. Mira Reed was 16, a woman grown, but she stood no higher than her brother. All the Crannog men were small, she told Bran once, when he asked why she wasn't taller. Brown-haired, green-eyed, and flat as a boy, she walked with a supple grace that Bran could only watch and envy. Mira wore a long, sharp dagger, but her favorite way to fight was with a slender, three-pronged frog spear in one hand and a woven net in the other.
"Who's hungry?"
she asked, holding up her catch, two small silvery trout, and six fat green frogs.
I am, said Bran, but not for frogs.
Back at Winterfell, before all the bad things had happened, the Walders used to say that eating frogs would turn your teeth green and make moss grow under your arms. He wondered if the Walders were dead. He hadn't seen their corpses at Winterfell, but there had been a lot of corpses, and they hadn't looked inside the buildings.
"We'll just have to feed you, then,"
Will you help me clean the catch, Bran?"
He nodded. It was hard to sulk with Mira. She was much more cheerful than her brother, and always seemed to know how to make him smile. Nothing ever scared her or made her angry. Well, except Jojen sometimes. Jojen Reed